Welcome to the Grateful American Radio Show, hosted by author and publisher David Bruce Smith. What did George Washington do that you might not know about? What did Abe Lincoln know that could change the way you think about the Civil War? You'll learn about all that and more on this special show designed to restore excitement in American history. Let's get started. Hello, and welcome to the Grateful American Radio Show. We are here today with amazing author and historian, Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, the vice president of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, who is also the Saunders Director of the Robert H. Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello, as well as a professor of history at the University of Virginia. But perhaps his biggest claim to fame is that Andrew is the award-winning author of The Men Who Lost America, The American Revolution and the Fate of the Empire. He has lectured widely to both scholarly and general audiences, and for good reason. Andrew won the 2014 George Washington Book Prize for this amazing book. He also won the New York Historical Society American History Book Prize, the Francis Tavern Museum Book Award, and he was a finalist for the Guggenheim Lehrman Prize in Military History. So, Andrew, welcome to the Grateful American Radio Show. We can't wait to hear what's been going on since you won the prize in 2014.
Well, thank you very much, indeed, Hope, and it's lovely to be on the program. It's been very exciting, and I've had a lot of opportunities to speak, not only in America, in far-flung parts of the country, including California, but in Antigua and in England.
Wow, that's fantastic. So David Bruce Smith, who founded the Grateful American Foundation, we had the opportunity to come to your office and interview you right after you won the prize. And so much has happened since then. So you've been speaking around the world. What else has happened? What are some perks of winning all these fantastic awards been?
Well, it won a total of 8 prizes, including the New York Historical Society Prize for American History, the Military History Prize, the National Society of Daughters of the American Revolution, and it was a finalist for the Guggenheim Lehrman Prize for Military History, and also the Kandel Prize, which is a Canadian prize and the most valuable prize in history. It's been translated into Chinese. So it really has been a wonderful experience.
Amazing. So for anyone who may not have had the opportunity to read the book, could you just give us a little quick summary of it?
Yes. Well, the book is about the British side of the American Revolution. And it's written rather like a play or a film. There are 10 major characters who are the leading British decision makers during the war, both political and military. It introduces each character at the point in the war in which they are most important. And it really shows these people to be very substantial. It's a little bit like a book on the Vietnam War called The Best and the Brightest. Far from being buffoons, far from being mediocre, it shows them really to be very capable. And the reason for doing this is to deflect attention away from the role of personalities and to focus more on what I think is the real essence of this war and why it was lost, which to a large extent is to do with civilian support and the lack of it for the British, and also the size of their army. I say in the book they had an army of conquest, but not an army of occupation. They were able to take every major American city during the war, but they could never occupy territory. And one of the famous examples was in the South after they took Charleston in 1780 and 81, they largely crushed the Continental Army in the South with the victory of Cornwallis at Camden. But then their control of the South imploded as they faced what they called partisan gangs, what today we would think of as almost guerrilla warfare. And the British troops soon became outstretched, their supply lines were cut, and although there was no army in the south to really significantly oppose them, they were tied down and they really couldn't control territory. And one of the consequences of that was that they had to largely import their food needs from Britain, 3,000 miles away. They were never able to entirely feed and supply the army in America.
So what do you think would have shifted it? How do you think the British could have won?
I think it would have been very difficult. Their best opportunity was very early in the war, probably in 1776. If they'd succeeded at Brooklyn in surrounding Washington and capturing him, or on Manhattan, really a use of massive force initially, and the capture of Washington's army. But even then, it would not be guaranteed that they would have won. There were other Continental troops under different commanders. It would have depended on just how determined the Patriots were to continue under any circumstances. But that was their best opportunity. Britain really didn't have a very large army, which is why they had to use Hessian mercenaries, why they sought allies in Native Americans and escaped slaves, which was unpopular in America, but almost necessary for the British, whose army was only about the sixth largest in Europe. It was really their navy that enabled them to have a large empire and to have such military prowess.
Fascinating. So the work that you've done there, I don't know how much it led to this next position, because you were just recently appointed as the first Sons of the American Revolution visiting professor at King's College in London to contribute to the Georgian Papers program. And in this inaugural role, you will have early access to the extensive archive of King George III's private papers as part of a major joint project with King's and the Royal Archive. And that sounds just fantastic. So tell us how that came to be and what you're going to be doing in this role.
Well, this is actually funded by the Sons of the American Revolution, which is very remarkable because obviously the papers deal with the British side of the war. But it's probably the most important unpublished and in many cases never before accessed papers dealing with the American Revolutionary War. The papers of George III are in the Round Tower at Windsor Castle. They're part of the Royal Library, and only 15% of them have been published. There are over 450,000 pages, not only of George III's papers, but also of British officials like Sir Samuel Hood, who was the second in command at the vitally important Battle of the Chesapeake Capes, and they also have the papers going from George I to William IV, basically from 1714 to 1837. But I'm going to largely be looking at those of George III. Some of those were published for the period of the American Revolution by an editor called Sir John Fortescue, but he was famously inaccurate, so much so that in the 20th century, Sir Lewis Namier, a British historian, did a book of corrections of Fortescue's correspondence of George III, and the book just dealt with 1 year. So it gives you an idea of just how inaccurate the transcriptions were. The other problem is that these papers were never indexed, and so historians really don't know exactly what is in the Royal Archives. It was very difficult to visit. You had to get written permission. They weren't open for most of the week. There weren't places for researchers to sit. You know, the Round Tower is really very small. They didn't have Wi-Fi if you were using a computer or places really to charge your computer. So this represents a major change of policy in which they're going to open up this archive and digitize it and make it available to anyone and people who could access it here in the United States.
That's amazing. What do you think you're going to find, or what are you hoping to find?
Well, I'm looking at the extent to which George III was involved in devising the military strategy. As king, he was very much like the President of the United States. He was commander-in-chief of the army and indeed all of the armed forces. He was indeed supposed to be involved in military policy. Constitutionally, he would discuss strategy with members of the cabinet, and so it was usually a joint decision. However, he had a particular interest in the military. He could pretty well name most of the officers in the army. You know, he knew about them personally. He had lots of arcane military knowledge. He was supposed to be able to tell you the depths and soundings of many of the ports in Europe and elsewhere. He was Britain's most knowledgeable king about the navy since James II in the late 17th century. And he took great interest in the strategy in America, so much so that the orders for John Burgoyne in his march south from Canada, what proved to be a disastrous march that ended in Saratoga, the turning point of the war. But those orders are written in the hand of George III. And so I'm investigating the extent to which he really dominates the discussion of military strategy. I noticed that the minister responsible, the cabinet minister, Lord George Germain, who is Secretary State for America, he often uses the same language as George III, as if almost to echo and concur with the king's views. George III was all in favor of what he called bold strategy. He didn't have much time for commanders like Sir William Howe at the beginning of the war, although initially he'd been very pro-Howe. But he felt Howe was not aggressive enough. Similarly, with Sir Henry Clinton, who was commander-in-chief of the second half of the war, he liked these more daring junior commanders like John Burgoyne and Lord Cornwallis. But these were the commanders who were ultimately defeated in battle and you know, were largely responsible for the British failure in America.
You have an incredible knowledge about this, and you make it so interesting to read. It's fantastic. What are the logistics of this project? How will it fit in with your work as Vice President of Monticello?
Yes, well, the professorship is for 2 months, and I'm dividing that time between November and February in order that it doesn't interfere too much with my administrative responsibilities here at Monticello. The award helps to give a higher profile to our work here and to the Robert H. Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies. It gives me the opportunity to meet other scholars who are working in the 18th century and who could be potential fellows, since we give fellowships ourselves at Monticello. It gives me an opportunity to give talks in Britain. I'm going to be giving what's called the John Rule. John Rule was quite a well-known historian of 18th century Britain, and there's an annual lecture in his name at Southampton University, which I'll give in February. I shall also be giving a talk at King's College, and I'm also going to be speaking at Eton, where a third of the subjects of the book went to school. And it's entitled, and this is really tongue-in-cheek, The American Revolution Was Lost on the Playing Fields of Eton? It was famously said at the Battle of Waterloo that it was won on the playing fields of Eton.
Well, there you go. So tell us about what's going on at the Robert H. Smith International Center at Monticello. What are you guys working on these days?
Well, we do conferences both overseas and domestic. This year we did a conference in Hong Kong on propaganda and the American Revolution. We plan among our domestic conferences next year to do a conference on education in the early Republic. So they're very much Jefferson related, but not necessarily specifically on Jefferson, but there are always some papers and some speakers who deal specifically with Jefferson, but we try and keep it as broad as possible. We edit the papers of Thomas Jefferson for his retirement period. We publish this year volume 13, and we'll do volume 14 next year. These volumes cover the period in which he founded the University of Virginia. They also cover his famous retirement correspondence with John Adams, which is possibly one of the great correspondences of all time. And here we're two retired presidents of the United States. They'd both been leading patriots during the American Revolution. They'd both sat on the committee for the Declaration of Independence. And in this correspondence, they cover all manner of subjects, ranging from the sciences to current politics. And it's remarkable just the range and depth of the knowledge of them both. I'm always particularly fascinated in the way that they reflect on the meaning of the American Revolution. And also, they occasionally disagree about some of the events of the American Revolution, not least the writing of the Declaration of Independence. In addition, we have about 30 scholars visit on fellowships every year. And when they're here, they give talks and help to keep us very current with the scholarship on the early Republic.
Actually, this is a great opportunity to ask you a few questions about Jefferson, if you don't mind.
Yes, please do.
So from his revolutionary period to his retirement, he accomplished many things. How do you think his view of America evolved over time? And did he change his mind on any long-held beliefs during his retirement?
He's often said to have contradicted himself, and it's inevitable that a politician who's interested in ideas but is also very active is likely to contradict themselves over the course of their career. I often think of Edmund Burke, who is a British politician who's regarded as the father of modern conservatism, and who indeed has had an even bigger influence in terms of the philosophy of politics. But he changed his views on issues over the course of his career. Probably the most famous example with Jefferson is that he's always accused of having been a hypocrite for writing that all men are created equal, and yet owning over 600 slaves during the course of his lifetime. In fact, he'd been one of the early people to speak up against slavery. He called it an abomination. In his early legal career, there are examples of him defending free black people who came up into court and who were defending their right to remain free. In the Declaration of Independence, he originally included a paragraph condemning the slave trade. In his only written book, Notes on the State of Virginia, he called for the gradual emancipation of slaves. He had really quite impressive anti-slavery credentials, but there's no doubt in his later life he speaks up on the subject much less. One of his nephews asked him to revive his interest in slavery, and he basically said this is for another generation. The problem by then was that slavery had gained a new lease of life with cotton, and that if he had become an outspoken critic of slavery, he could never have been elected president of the United States. His opponents in the Federalist Party were privately critical of slavery, but certainly neither John Adams nor other leading Federalists really tried to push the issue when they were in power.
Yeah, it's complicated, very complicated. It's hard to be black and white, literally, about the subject, yes. And you all do a really remarkable job explaining it, I think.
We've actually built, based on the archaeology, some of the slave cabins here. And we've also interviewed over 200 descendants of the families. And we're continuing that project and expanding the number of interviews, which you can find on our website. We just recently had a gathering of descendants here at Monticello, as well as a major two sessions for the last day of the National Endowment of the Humanities 50th anniversary, in which the panels discussed the relationship of race and slavery and the consequences.
Yeah, you have a wonderful experts on slavery there. And I know Mount Vernon on October 1st released a new exhibit that focused on the slaves that George Washington had. So this is a topic that's definitely getting more attention. I mean, it's been getting attention for a long time, but it's really interesting to dive down into it and to really understand the underpinnings of it and what was going on politically and economically at the time.
That's right. I mean, it is the darkest side of the American Revolution. We at the same time celebrate what is best in America and some of the higher ideals, but I think there's a responsibility to talk about both.
Yeah, and I think that leads to my next question about how Jefferson was perceived by Americans then and now, and how is he perceived by himself, do you think?
Well, he was always quite a polarizing figure, even in his own lifetime. I mean, there were those who detested him, the supporters who hugely admired him. Merrill Peterson, who was a famous historian of Jefferson, did a book about Jefferson over the course of time and Jefferson's reputation. And in it, he showed that his reputation has waxed and waned throughout the 19th century and early 20th century. It probably reached the zenith of its popularity in the 1940s, 50s, and early 60s. And this was really during the Cold War period, in which Jefferson became one of the great symbols for freedom. Then with the rise of the civil rights movement, you start to get a more nuanced view of Jefferson and more of a tendency to question him, to the extent now that we almost celebrate his opponents more, like Alexander Hamilton, which is very ironic because of all of the founders, Jefferson was really the most radical and the one who most trusted the idea of the people and who was least fearful of the consequences of democracy, whereas Hamilton often showed that he really rather despised the whole idea of democracy and favored a much more elitist approach to politics.
Yes, well, I think the whole fiduciary system based on the Bank of England was a good example of that.
You know, he was a great architect of the American economic system, and Hamilton was wonderful in his own right, but it's ironic that he's, you know, the subject of a musical and that he's become so popular because he was so distrustful of democracy. But it reminds us that really our current system is due to two different political parties with completely opposing visions, and yet we really owe a great debt to both of them.
Yes, and I think it's that deep understanding and that ability to have a perspective on it that makes understanding history and current times important. So thank you for that. In fact, my next question is, what impact do you think Jefferson's ideas have on the world today?
Well, I think he still ranks as one of the most eloquent writers on the topic of liberty and the dangers of despotism. And he's still an inspiration. I'm always amazed at how many people abroad read his writings and have been inspired by his writings, and who tend to focus on him more than almost any other American.
That's been my experience, just anecdotally. When I ask people who their favorite founding father was, he is always, always the person that they name.
Yes, I talked about his reputation waxing and waning, but he's always high in the list of America's most popular presidents.
And Ben Franklin, it's interesting too. He's actually my favorite founding father. And when you read his, biographies about him, he was popular as America's taste change and unpopular. So when entrepreneurism is popular, Franklin is popular and the opposite. So, it's interesting who we gravitate to at what period in time.
It is, and it depends a lot on the circumstances of the time as to how we evaluate people in the past. And also, of course, new evidence and new information can change our attitude towards them.
So with the election not far away, how do you think things are going to play out based on sort of historical experience, knowledge?
Well, I'm not sure that necessarily, the election can always potentially go either way due to unforeseen circumstances. So historians are great believers in the possibility of contingencies, that things can go different ways due to matters of chance. So if one candidate, say, suddenly fell ill and died, and things that you could never anticipate, but which can indeed happen and change the circumstances. I'm giving a lecture shortly on the election of 1800, which was perhaps one of the first examples. There had been an earlier election of 1796, but it became especially vicious in 1800, with lots of examples of negative advertising.
Yes. Yes, I think historically, this isn't the first time we've seen it, although I hear that a lot. This is the worst election in history. Do you not agree with that?
Well, I think the worst must always be 1860 and Abraham Lincoln, because that led directly to civil war.
Well, on that happy note, are you working on another book?
Yes, I am. I'm doing a book about Jefferson's founding of the University of Virginia. The title has a quote from him, The Illimitable Freedom of the Human Mind, Thomas Jefferson's Idea of a University. He listed it as one of his three great achievements in life. He asked to have those listed on his tombstone, and the last was Father of the University of Virginia. I'm interested partly because I think higher education is in crisis, especially public education, and his ideas, which were so creative, are inspiring as to what higher education can be. It's also quite significant that Jefferson, in many ways, was very libertarian, and yet, in terms of education, he really advocated radical expansion of government to fund education. The university was just the apex of his vision. He wanted to introduce a public system of education for boys and girls from the earliest ages, which would have really created the first truly public education system in the world, and would certainly have given Virginia a huge advantage. He never managed to get that through the local legislature, but in retirement, really in his late 70s, he did manage to realize his vision of having a university for the state that he could see from Monticello, they used the best architects, the architects that they were using to build Washington, D.C., Benjamin Latrobe and William Thornton, while Jefferson designed the main campus and the main building, the rotunda, which was to house the library and to be at the center of the university. They used the best marble, and the cost of building it was huge. I mean, it was certainly the biggest building project in America at that time.
Wow. It's fascinating. Well, we look forward to that book. What is the title?
The Illimitable Freedom of the Human Mind, Thomas Jefferson's Idea of a University. And I hope to get it out for the bicentenary of the university, which will be in 2019 with the University of Virginia Press.
Fantastic. Well, we very much look forward to it. And just keeping up with you, Andrew, you are always doing something fascinating in the history community and just in general. We really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
We are talking to Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, author of The Men Who Lost America, British Leadership, The American Revolution, and the Fate of the Empire, an award-winning book. He is also the vice president of Monticello and the Saunders director of the Robert H. Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies at the Jefferson Foundation and professor of history at the University of Virginia. And your accolades and titles and awards go on. So we look forward to keeping up with you, Andrew. Best of luck to you at King's College.
Lovely speaking to you, Hope. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. You are listening to the Grateful American Radio Show. This is Hope Gibbs, your co-host. David Bruce Smith will be with us again next time. He's the founder of the Grateful American Foundation. And we all look forward to talking to you guys soon. Have a great day.
You have been listening to the Grateful American Radio Show, hosted by author and publisher David Bruce Smith. Here's to restoring enthusiasm in history for kids and adults, too.